You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this THE podcast, where I'm joined in the park by Ben Braben, who was formerly Reader in English Literature and Digital Education at Edge Hill, but is now Academic Courses Manager in the School of Arts and Humanities at Nottingham Trent University. Thanks for joining me, Ben.
Thanks, Chris, for talking to me. Thank you.
No problem. I have you down here in my notes as a MOOCer. You ran what we covered in the THE as a spooky MOOC. It was a MOOC on vampire fiction, which ran last year. It was the first for-credit UK MOOC, but no one actually opted to pay for that credit when it actually came to it. Did you learn a lot from that experience?
I certainly did learn a lot. I think that as a lecturer, as a teacher, it was a rewarding experience. And I think when I set out, I wasn't necessarily looking to have 100,000 students opt for credit, although perhaps institutionally that would have been wonderful. I think in terms of opening up the learning experience to a wider audience, and in terms of actually connecting with like-minded individuals who are interested in vampire fiction, that was a great success. And I had some really rewarding discussions and interactions with students that I could have never brought to class, students from Brazil, students from Australia, students from America, that I would have never been able to have in class. And also I learned a lot about actually the processes of accrediting MOOCs, about how to actually design and regulate a MOOC that was, again, sort of treading into unknown territory and water that hadn't been sort of swum through before.
Mm-hmm. And did you find the QAA, presumably, apart from anyone else, that would be far more interested in your MOOC as one which is being awarding credit than it would others? Did you sort of discuss with them at all the implications?
Yes, and I think that your listeners will be aware that the QAA has taken perhaps quite a sort of standoff position with regard to MOOCs. If they haven't been through a process of formal validation, if they haven't been for credit, then their position, QA's position, is that really it's nothing to do with them. So by having a MOOC for credit, for 20 credits, we're immediately entering into QA territory. They were fascinated by this. I would say from the point of view of actually offering credit and going through the institutional validation process, it raised questions about the quality code and the QA were particularly interested in, and whether the quality code was actually up to deal with MOOCs, because
fit for purpose
in the sense that the acronym MOOC does not exist in the quality code. They have made a statement about MOOCs, but it isn't anywhere. It's covered, I suppose, in a blanket way through online learning, distance learning, but it didn't exist. So in many ways, the QA was responding as well to the very sort of possibility of actually delivering something massive, open, online without actually having any specific guidelines from them. So yes, they were fascinated. They were really intrigued. It was almost in a way a case study for how it might stand up. And I think reflecting upon it, I think that we adopted quite a conservative approach to accrediting the MOOC, in the sense that we asked exactly the same questions of a module on campus. We couldn't get away from that. There weren't a different set of questions we're asking in many ways because of the regulations. We had to make sure that it stood up to on-campus provision. I think the flip side of that is, and I've mentioned this before, is a tension between openness and containment. And I think that's what the sort of, by putting credit in the mix, I think that always almost like problematizes the relationship with openness, because there are limits on openness when you're giving something away that is, in the case of vampire fiction, worth 20 credits.
Yeah. And I mean, the 20 credits wasn't an open course, was it? You had to pay for that. I mean, the course was free to everyone.
That was very interesting semantics, yes. The course was free and open, but if you wanted your transcript, yes, it was a processing, I suppose, fee of £200, which I suppose is very, very competitive when you're looking at a £9,000 a year degree. And I think the rationale behind that was the sense that we can't just give this away for free. You have to have a nominal amount on it, because what would this do to higher education if one university can give 20 credits away for free? Then actually, you know, it undermines, I suppose, the fee paying model. But perhaps it should. That's what I would say. Perhaps it should.
But that sort of plays into the hype. I mean, we've covered it in THG, the hype cycle, if you like.
Yes.
What does this mean for the rest of THG? So far, we haven't really seen a huge knock-on effect.
And I think the reason is because of this question of misalignment, in the sense that the students who want to take MOOCs are not your, you know, typical 18-year-old undergraduate who wants to gain their degree remotely at a distance via a MOOC. They are, as you know, all the statistics still demonstrate, you know, upward of 70% already have a first degree, maybe even a second degree. This is about lifelong learning. This is about cultural enrichment. It's about engaging with things that you wouldn't necessarily do in your day-to-day life. It's the actual enjoyment just of learning. And I think that was the case of vampire fictions. You know, there were some enthusiasts that loved vampire fiction or gothic fiction, but the majority of them, it was more about soft skills, it was more about transferable skills, it was more about sort of creativity as well, and reading text and discussing text that they wouldn't normally have the opportunity to do. One thing I'd add to that, perhaps, is within that context, though, it was reassuring for students that it had been through a process of institutional validation, that even if they weren't aiming for credit, they knew it was of a certain level, of a certain standard. And I think that's a question more broadly about MOOCs. There's been a lot of light touch approach because of, you know, the QA's sort of distance from regulating MOOCs. And what does that mean? You know, the MOOC you're taking, is it really even university level course? You know, there are certainly some MOOCs out there that aren't. So,
Is that because they're going for mass appeal and they want the big number?
I agree. I think that you know, sometimes you could argue that pedagogy, you know, suffers in the context of popular appeal, in terms of pitching a MOOC, in terms of its levelness within sort of institutional sort of structures, I think yes, it would be fair to say in many cases that openness has actually transformed, I suppose, levelness that they may be delivered by universities, but not necessarily university level courses.
They've been around for quite a while now, of course.
They have their history already now.
We mentioned this hype cycle, things settling down a little bit, which is why I was a little bit surprised to hear that this week, in fact, you're working with or joining Hefke's Teaching, Learning and the Student Experience Strategic Advisory Committee, specifically in the role of a sort of MOOCs advisor, MOOCs consultant.
Yes.
Hasn't the ship rather sailed on? Are they not a little bit slow up the mark here?
I think... Yes, I think up to a point, yes. I think, you know, we're over sort of 2 years in. I mean, if you go back to Siemens and Downs MOOC in 2008, you could say we're a long way from when that ship sailed. But I think there's a realisation that it's not just about MOOCs. It's about MOOCs as focusing debates around digital learning, about online learning, distance learning, it's never happened before in this way, at least for 20 years. And so I think the hype around MOOCs is now being sort of filtered down into broader questions around digital online learning. The idea of the digital students is something that we're talking about only earlier today. The digital student is, you know, what is a digital student? And MOOCs have certainly brought that into focus. So I think that in terms of Hefke's position in relationship to MOOCs that's currently evolving and developing, they're looking to fund, to invest in initiatives and innovations that actually harness the power that MOOCs have, or at least I suppose the pedagogical potential that MOOCs have, to change the learning landscape. So, to give you an example of this, you know, to think about the academic no longer as the sage on the sage, but the academic as curator or co-curator of knowledge. Also finding ways to support knowledge that's created within more of a social context, knowledge that requires, I suppose, collectivity and community to shape it, as opposed to some form of perhaps sort of, you know, radical individualism that perhaps the academic still sort of has, you know, in terms of their expertise. And that's a difficult one to actually, I suppose, sort of, you know, pinpoint. How does a body like Hefke actually find ways to support that?
Have they put some money to one side?
Well, this is something they're obviously, you know, discussing and looking at. I think there is a broad agenda here. You know, if you think about the TQSE group, there are a lot of parties involved, you know, like the QAA, like JISC. They're going to look to find ways to actually, you know, connect with institutions and connect with specific sort of innovations in this area. This is the beginning of a road for them in many ways, and I think that you know, while you say yes, the ship may have already sailed, I don't think that the UK higher education it perhaps necessarily has completely, because I think we're a little bit further behind on that hype cycle, in the sense that perhaps the UK has been playing catch up. You're thinking about sort of Coursera's American platform, we're so far behind in terms of numbers, if it is just all about numbers. And FutureLearn, although it's been successful, it hasn't quite had the reach that Coursera has. And I think that there's sort of scrutiny going on about that in terms of, I suppose, a sort of UK brand of higher education, how that might be used to connect through sort of higher education networks within the QAA context. And I'm sure you've heard this muted many times about a sort of international quality code. So the opportunities that come out of the I suppose, sort of power of MOOCs to connect learners and academics as well, and trying to tap into that and harness that perhaps more strategically. And that's what they're looking into. That's what they're looking to find ways to actually fund that centrally.
Why do you think FutureLearn has struggled maybe to replicate the early success of Coursera? I mean, I hear talking to many people, not only is it missing two key players, obviously Oxford and Cambridge haven't provided MOOCs, they're big brands, they would get people in, but also other universities, maybe such as Edgehill, and I know the Institute of Education as well, had MOOCs that they wanted to put on FutureLearn, but that they were struggling to have accepted by that platform. Was that the case in Edgehill?
I think it was the case. I mean, I can understand their rationale, FutureLearn's rationale, in the sense that I think they probably did look at the Times are higher rankings, and they made a choice there about who should be in and who should be out, and that's all about, I suppose, developing a brand and a brand identity. And part of me says, that was a measure. I mean, perhaps the Times higher rankings perhaps shouldn't be used in that way, but they chose to use it that way. So that was their logic, that was their rationale. But I think perhaps as a sort of ethos of MOOCs and thinking about sort of open learning more broadly and OER as well, it seems to go against the very idea of what they should be about. But that isn't to say that MOOCs can't happen in other environments. I think though there is strength in numbers, and I think when you think about the Hefke context and thinking about an international sort of position that UK higher education sort of sits within, then I think there needs to be a more sort of strategic approach to opening that up and giving more access to other institutions, because MOOCs rely upon in a way this is the mashup of course material. If they're going to evolve and succeed, they can't be just about one institution offering their particular specialism to gather or grab, I suppose, column inches. They've got to be about what's underlying, and it's got to be about students, it's got to be about the learning experience, it's got to be about knowledge, it's got to be about how we understand education in the 21st century. And I think that's to hold on to things and to try and keep possession of things in a very sort of insular way is not the way forward.
Well, that's difficult, isn't it? Because even when you produce a basic MOOC with your Sage on the Stage type address to camera, as you described earlier, universities are spending sort of tens of thousands of pounds developing them.
Yes.
And they're the most obvious model to take. Do you think we can convince universities to invest more time in making them a better experience for students, or are they just adverts?
Well, I think they have been adverts, but I think if Hefke's role in this context develops, and I think they will be more than that, and I think that the power of connectivist pedagogies and the power of changing the way we understand learning and understand the student experience, thinking more about the idea of the digital student and approaching it with a sort of pedagogy of what I might describe as sort of digital thinking, and that is, I suppose, a sort of cultural change. Talking earlier, thinking about institutional sort of resistance, it's on both sides, in the sense that those debates about digital native, digital immigrant have been well rehearsed, but many students are still uncomfortable using with institutional virtual learning platforms and getting used to how learning is delivered online. And the other side of that is staff as well, having to adapt to fast changing technologies. It's about sort of constantly staying, I suppose, sort of on top of your game, and without investment, that's not going to happen. But equally, I think it's part of that resistance is the way things are structured. So, in the more radical end of how I see this, and perhaps the more radical end of how this might evolve, is moving away from the still fairly static 3-year degree model to reimagine that, the campus degree system. You know, that needs to be sort of reimagined in a world where you can have perhaps, you know, three or four times your student cohort on campus taking a MOOC. And they'll never visit, and they'll never be part of that campus experience. So I think there are opportunities there to reconsider how we might actually reimagine higher education.
They'll never give any money either, those students, though, will they? I mean, now that we've shifted the funding system so heavily onto the student, I mean, the free student isn't of any interest.
Well, I suppose there is no such thing as a free student, even if it looks that way. And I think that perhaps it's where the relation between sort of knowledge and power perhaps resides. So there's certainly evidence out of, you know, take London as an example, University of London example. They certainly have evidence that there has been nearly 150 students, I think their last report, have moved from their MOOCs onto their on-campus degree program. So there's a funding model there. But I think it's also about access to higher education. I think it's about there is a market there that can be brought in through changing the perceptions about what higher education is about, and, you know, throwing off perhaps what might be seen as sort of stuffy, remote, disconnected ideas about higher education. And that sort of played out in a slightly different context, in sort of, you know, ref agendas on the sort of research side, in terms of impact agenda and connecting with the public, with an audience beyond the walls of the institution. So I think MOOCs have a role to play there. I mean, I always use the example of academics at Edinburgh at the moment, working on digital literacies and using MOOCs and LOOCs, little open online courses, to connect with refuse collectors in Edinburgh, because they need certain digital skills to actually collect the rubbish, literally. And it seems like a great, you know, headline capturing story, but there is something in the ability to change people's lives here, to offer free education that will actually transform, not necessarily looking in the really short term. This is a longer term strategy, that this is about education and culture enriching program that will evolve over years and years, and it will change the nature's sort of cultural fabric.
So we'll still have MOOCs in 3 or 4 years' time, I think.
I think we will, and certainly from Pepe's perspective, I think we will. And I think that they won't necessarily be the same. I think that the power of things like gamification, the power to truly sort of mash up education, hasn't been realised. And I think there are some sort of technological innovations that still need to be funded. And I think GIST will have a role to play in that as well. And I think that we may be moving out of the trough, and sort of slowly climbing back up. But I think that the landscape ahead is actually exciting. There's a lot of potential there with the right type of support, and I think that MOOCs will evolve. I think that I mentioned earlier, LOOCs, little open online courses, I think that sort of tailored personal education is one way to go. Research certainly indicates as well that it's the power to individualise learning in a way that's never really happened before, and perhaps it seems like a paradox that you could be individual when there might be 20,000, 30,000 students in your class, but it's about learning when you want to learn. It's about the flexibility. It's about dropping in and dropping out of learning. It's about not being burdened with, I suppose, completion rates in a very sort of formal way, that you have to get through this module. You can learn in a formative way, and that's always a dilemma, because we don't really, I think, reward formative learning as much as we should. So much emphasis put on summative learning, the final result, whereas you learn a lot on the journey. And I think there is going to be a sort of cultural change there around how we understand the process of formative learning, particularly MOOC students, and how they've experienced MOOCs, that they may not necessarily be just doing it for a certificate of completion or to gain credit. It's about the formative learning journey.
I've rarely spoken to somebody who runs a MOOC who is big on completion rates, talking about that, so no change there. Ben Brabham, Academic Courses Manager in the School of Arts and Humanities at Nottingham Trent University, thanks very much for joining.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.